Welcome back to the Music History Project. Great to have you with us today because we have a very, very special topic. One of my favorite bands, Yes. Join us. Welcome to the Music History Project. We are your hosts. I'm Dan Del Fiorentino.
And I'm Alex Rossner.
All of the content of our podcast is based on the Oral History Collection, which is sponsored by NAMM, the National Association of Music Merchants. This collection is over 5,000 interviews and growing. To learn more, check it out on nam.org/library. Well, hey, everybody. We are so excited about today's podcast. Alex, are you thrilled?
I am excited over the top.
I know this is one of your favorite bands too, Alex. So I'm very, very happy that we're going to be talking about the band Yes. Yes, we are. And to help us with that, I am more than pleased to have our good friend, a personal friend and a dear friend of NAMM, Mr. Bill. Mr. Bill Kilpatrick is here. Thank you so much for joining us, Bill.
And Dan and Alex, thank you for inviting me here. I could talk about this band for days.
Well, maybe a quick introduction from you, your impression of the band Yes.
Absolutely. Sonic territory that I had never experienced in rock music before. Stellar musicians, all masters of their craft. And on top of that whole beautiful mix is the angelic voice of John Anderson.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget those songs.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, man.
Just a great combination of the perfect storm type of thing, right?
Yeah. It was a perfect storm that came together. And, you know, I think it was the perfect time for their music. I believe it was 1968, when John Anderson and Chris Squire first met and started talking about putting the band together. And John has always said, I wanted to write music that was adventurous, that would take our audience on a wild ride. You know, I didn't really want to write Hey, Hey, Baby, I Love You. And, of course, he's a very well-read man, so he would read Siddhartha and he would read War and Peace and get ideas for these, what he calls them, long-form pieces. And they're just perfect.
Absolutely. I should tell the audience a little bit about you, Mr. Bill, because you know John Anderson personally. So this is an extra treat for us because in addition to playing highlights from the NAMM oral history interview we have with John, thanks to Mr. Bill, we get your insight into some of the things he didn't talk about because he's not a boastful man. So this is our chance to kind of talk him up a little bit.
Yeah,
and shed some light on the man behind that great music. But we're going to hear from some other members of the band too.
Oh, great.
So I'm really excited about that. For example, the drummer. Right. We got to talk about Bill.
Okay.
Did you meet Bill?
I had not met Bill. I've met John through the internet, and we've worked together for quite a bit, I think from about 2005. I got to shake Rick's hand one time, Rick Wakeman's hand. They were playing down here in San Diego, and I'll tell you what, that man has some big hands on him. So it's obvious why he was able to cover so much territory with his keyboard playing. I did get to interview John on the Mom at Home program that BJ and I had here during the COVID shutdown. And I also interviewed a gentleman who played with Yes on their Magnification tour, where they were playing with full orchestras. A gentleman named Tom Brislin. Have you interviewed Tom?
I have not yet.
If I were you, I'd look him up.
Let's do it.
Currently, he's playing for Kansas, and a very young man who just mastered the keyboards, as you have to do to play in a band of that nature. So I had a real nice interview with Tom on Mom at Home. I was hoping to get Bill Bruford on board, but that wasn't able to happen. So, you know, I did meet them off and on, got to chat with Alan White once for a minute.
Cool.
Dreams come true.
No doubt. Well, so back in 2018, we also, with Alex's help, do you remember the interview with Trevor Evan?
That was amazing. That was a great, great encounter.
What an amazing guy who's so grateful, took his time to chat with us and answer my dumb questions, and of course, tell that fantastic story about owner of a lonely heart.
Right.
In fact, if you don't mind, Alex, maybe we can cue up that segment of his interview and play Trevor from his 2018 NAMM Oral History interview talking about that great song.
I had a friend in South Africa, and we used to just sit there with two acoustics and write. We used to write songs, and I got the feeling about it was just during the Beatles coming out, and that's where the passion for writing came out. So I've always kind of, always, from 15 onwards, I've always kind of written. And one thing I realized is no rules, and you can't really teach it. Now, as far as orchestration, there's certainly, you can equip yourself to do, as far as writing, you can certainly equip yourself with a lot of the rules and regulations and the formal analysis and the procedures, how to write score and charts and stuff, and that's a help with that. But if you're just writing a song, for example, Owner of a Lonely Heart is a good example. I just came up with a riff, dun, 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 and that sat in my brain for quite some time. And I don't know, is it too simple? Is it maybe just so simple that it's really ordinary? Or is it something? I didn't know. And then I started slowly putting things around it, and then one visit to the bathroom was quite a lengthy one. I was playing it, and I wrote the chorus, the lyrics, everything about it I wrote, and it started coming together. And then I thought, okay, this is ready to do. And at the time, it was four track. We were working on 24 track, 48 track machines, even so far as digital tape recorders, dash systems were just coming out. But I had a four track unit, so I used to record three tracks and then mix them to the fourth track, and then use that mixed track and then two more and mix that to the track and just loop them over like that, so I could do 12, 15, 20 overdubs. They would hiss a lot because it was analog, but it worked. One of the consequences on Owner of doing that is some of the bangs, you know, the brass hits and that, I had mixed too loud for the mix. And I got used to it, so when we did the final record, I wanted those also to be too loud. So on the record, those things are too loud also. And that kind of helped.
We just listened to a couple of minutes of Trevor Rabin. And Bill, would you tell us a little bit more about him?
Sure. Trevor is known, of course, to Yes fans as being the gentleman who infuse some new life into the band in the early 80s. Yes's heyday at first was when they hit the scene in the late 60s, and the 70s were their golden decade where these amazing long-form pieces came about. The Gates of Delirium, Heart of the Sunrise, and You and I, Close to the Edge, and of course their double album that was four sides, one song each side, called Tales from Topographic Oceans. They really dug deep and explored all these ethereal, otherworldly ideas that John Anderson had come across. Well, toward the end of the 70s, of course, we had disco, we had punk, and all these other genres appear, and all of a sudden, what has been labeled progressive rock or classical rock sort of got pushed to the side. So, Yes did regroup with a couple of guys from the Buggles for a little while, and then sort of disappeared for a bit. But then Chris Squire, bass player, and Trevor Rabin and Alan White got together, and they were putting a band together called Cinema. They'd written several songs, and everything was sounding good, but I believe it was Chris, might have been Trevor, who called John and said, you know, come on down. We want you to hear what we're working on. Hmm. And John, being the his creative engine is always firing on all cylinders. And he said, well, yeah, it's quite good, but I have some ideas. And, of course, John added his vocals, and it became Yes. Owner of a Lonely Heart became their, I believe, only number one singles. They've had some top 10, I think. Roundabout certainly was there. But I believe Owner was the only number one single they had, and it all of a sudden put Yes back on the map. So that's what Trevor's credited with for that band. And if I can add, he has a wicked sense of humor. I had the opportunity to meet Trevor when a friend of mine, Tim Heinz, an amazing keyboardist, writer, arranger, was working with Trevor on the score for the movie Enemy of the State with Gene Hackman and Will Smith. And Tim called me up once and said, "Hey, you want to come up and hear some of the orchestra going down to, you know, tape?"
Wow.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
It was very fascinating.
Sign me up.
In this particular instance, anyway, they recorded the string section individually, then they would record the brass individually, the woodwinds. And again, you know, kid in a candy store, I was just wide-eyed. And Trevor showed up to the session, and we chatted, we talked, and had a good time. And then afterwards, they said, "Oh, let's go have a beer." Don't have to ask me twice. So we're in some pub somewhere, and I cornered Trevor, and I said, "I got to tell you, Trevor, I have a 10-year-old son named Brennan who is so enamored of your film score for, actually, it was for Con Air. At 10 years old, my son Brennan asked for the Con Air CD soundtrack for Christmas. That's pretty darn hip." And Trevor, Trevor's not a short man. He's tall, and he sort of looked down at me. He said, "Oh, your son's got really bad taste in music too, eh?" I just thought, now there's a genius who is very humble about it.
Right, grounded.
Wonderful guy.
For sure.
Wonderful
yeah.
guy.
They all seem that way. I've yeah. interviewed several of them as we've talked about, and they all have given me the same impression.
Yeah.
You know, they're grounded, they're grateful for where they're at, mm-hmm. they're happy that they've been able to provide something that they've entertained and moved people,
right.
and they take that seriously.
Yeah.
It's not just, "Oh, okay, thanks to the audience." No, mm-hmm. they live it. That's
right.
what they wanted to do. That's what they set out to do, and they're glad that they did it.
Yeah, and we're glad they did it too.
No doubt.
What an amazing musical ride.
So one of the things that you were mentioning earlier that I think is worth poking a little bit more at is the concept of bringing in new sounds,
mm-hmm.
you know, not just arranging, but also bringing in new sounds. And this,
right.
of course, is where Rick Wakeman does an incredible job offering up new technology as it's being developed. This is the early 70s. Synthesizers are all the craze. And there's an amazing amount of innovative engineers working on electronic musical instruments at this time, and Rick jumps on board with several of them.
Right.
Can you tell the story about that young man named Dave Biro?
Sure can. Dave Biro, wonderful musician himself, was, as I am, a huge fan of Yes in that iteration and that stage of their career. And he would go to their concerts, and he became very enamored with Rick Wakeman. And, I mean, Rick Wakeman could cut through concrete with his solos on the Minimoog, right? They're just fantastic. Another instrument that Rick used was called the Mellotron, and that's an instrument that would create its sounds using actual tape loops inside the body of the instrument. When you depress a key, it starts that tape loop playing through a playback head. Really, I mean, I can't imagine how people come up with these ideas. Well, Dave was trying to amass a keyboard collection to mimic Rick Wakeman, and they were not cheap instruments back then. You know, the Minimoog, I mean, we're talking about the 70s. I want to say they're about $3,500 maybe, and Mellotron as well. So what Dave did was he took an old upright piano that was in his garage, and apparently he cut the center of the keyboard out of the piano, built a box around it, and I can't even begin to imagine the technology he came up with, but somehow he was able to wire every one of those keys to activate a tape inside of an 8-track cartridge. Okay, so when you would push a key down, it would play whatever note that key was sending information to. I'm sorry, that's the wrong way to put it. If you play an F key on the keyboard, it would activate the 8-track tape that had an F note recorded on it. So just like the Mellotron, you could play chords, you could play single line passages on it. One of the things that his idea sort of took to the next level with the Mellotron, you only had a certain number of seconds that you could hold the chord down. I've heard 8 seconds, I've heard 11 seconds, I'm not sure what it is.
I've heard eight also, yeah.
So let's just say 8 seconds. After 8 seconds, that tape has basically gone all the way into the little cartridge holder that moves up as you play the note, and you have to let the note go to drop the tape down. Now, Dave came up with an idea, again, using the 8-tracks, and that was an endless loop. The way he created that, because he sort of created these sounds by recording them onto these analog tapes is he would have two tape machines, and he would play a note. One tape would record the note. When it was getting toward the end of that, he would, I don't know how he had the patience to do this, turn down that one and turn up the other machine. And so it created this endless loop. And so his manager, Ed Cohen, and Dave wanted to get this instrument to Rick Wakeman. They drove their, I think it was a Pinto, he said, and this giant machine to an arena where Yes was playing, and managed to get backstage and talk to Rick and say, I've got an idea for you. Maybe you'd like to try it out. And of course, Dave, last name Biro, named it the Birotron. And so they brought it in, and Rick set it up. And according to what I've read and talked to Dave and Ed about, at a certain point, Rick put his head back as he was playing and then stopped and said, how would you like to make some money with this instrument? So Rick definitely fully got on board.
That is so awesome. Great, great story. Hey, let's go back to 2013 to the NAMM oral history interview with Dave and hear from him.
Okay.
Here he is.
You know, people expected they could just buy a Mellotron, plug it in, and it's going to sound, you know, they're going to sound like Rick Wakeman. Well, that wasn't the case. So, I went home and I was disappointed, and I'm just started mulling different ideas in my head, like, what can I do? What can I got to have the sounds, you know, those angelic sounds that come out of his music. And then little by little, you know, I just said, reel-to-reels were out of the question. It's got to be a tape source. And back then, there was just reel-to-reel. 8 tracks and cassettes. And cassettes were out of the question because they were not endless loop. Although you could get some endless loop cassettes that cost a fortune, but they weren't very reliable. But 8 tracks were already endless loop. And I don't know why I knew it had to be endless loop, because I still didn't have everything formed in my head. so I said, well, process of elimination, the only thing to do is something with 8 tracks. Before I even knew that this was going to work, I went thumbing through these catalogs, Electronic Surplus, and I saw they had these 8-track players, home 8-track players, on clearance. They were trying to get rid of them. They were BSR, and I forget how much they were, but I remember paying $400 for 19 of them, which again was a lot. It would be like $4,000 today, just not even knowing if this principle is going to work. But I had to take a shot, because I figured they all had to be the same machine, otherwise it would be impossible to work with. At one point, I knew I needed a keyboard, and you couldn't buy ready-made, you know, keyboards that you could just wire up. And a friend of mine was getting rid of an upright piano, and I talked to all my friends and helped me move it. We dragged the thing over to my house, and I literally chopped it up and just took the middle section of keys, the whole keyboard, just cut it out. And I had this great big mess in the driveway, you know, the soundboard and all the strings and all the wood and everything. What a mess. But so, anyways, I took this keyboard thing out, and I opened it up and figured out, well, what could I do, you know, what I put some switches underneath the keys or something, and so I went to Radio Shack to see what kind of switches I could use, and after a process of elimination, I finally came up with these micro switches that would fit here and there, whatever, underneath, and put rubber bands on the back of the key so they'd spring back and all this stuff. And so I said, okay, this is how I'll make the keyboard. But I still wasn't quite sure about the 8 tracks, what I was going to do. But now I had to have a sound source. And, well, I can play violin, but my tone, I mean, haven't practiced and this and that. And the other thing, didn't do good. And I figured, let me just take an easy way out. My a very good friend of mine at the time, and still today, Nick Stargiew, we call him Saint Nick, he owned a Mellotron. He just bought a Mellotron. Oh, I was so envious. You bastard, you know, how dare you? And I had been telling him and his band called Surprise my ideas. Nick was kind enough to lend me his precious, expensive Mellotron. And I it was like something to have this in my garage. And I made sure, I said, no, I don't even want to know how this thing works, because I don't want to be influenced. Not that I was ever planning on going into production or anything at the time, but I just didn't want to be influenced. For some reason, I wanted to do it myself. I recorded the 8 seconds of every Mellotron note and put it on reel-to-reel tapes and gave the Mellotron back to him. So now I had something to work with. Well, I made copies and took these single pieces of tape, made loops, and recorded the loops over and over onto 8 tracks. Now the problem with that is, there at the time, there was no way that you could take an analog sound and make it continuous, seemingly, you know, without a break. There was no way, because if you take like a violin and you make a loop, the beginning of the note is going to sound way different than the end of the note. And when the two meet together, when the loop comes around, you're going to hear something like, it's terrible. But anyways, I figured I'll cross that bridge later. So the main prototype did have that flaw. But, you know, it really wasn't that noticeable. If you're playing, because I think I had a pretty long loop, so that it would last 4 or 5 seconds. So even the chances, if you're playing fast notes, of hitting that little break, it was kind of remote. And if you're playing multiple notes, it covers each other up and everything. So the original prototype was made of Mellotron mixed strings. But it didn't sound anything like a Mellotron. It sounded nothing like a Mellotron. And as you'll find out later, when Rick Wakeman went to play it, he had trouble believing it was recorded from a Mellotron. He says, this sounds so much more mellow than a Mellotron. And it did. It had a sound of its own.
We just listened to Dave Biro talking about his Birotron invention. And Bill, would you tell us more about Rick Wakeman?
Well, I'd be happy to. Rick, I mean, how deep do we want to go? Rick has had such a storied career. What you may or may not know is that he's also a very in-demand comedian, one of the funniest guys you'll ever hear, meet, talk to. And at the time, he was sort of bopping around the music scene. He was a studio musician. A lot of people heard him before they even knew who he was. He played the beautiful piano on The Morning Has Broken for Cat Stevens. And if you ever get a chance to hear Rick tell that story, do it. Very, very funny. So he also became part of David Bowie's recording camp. And so his, you know, as I was saying earlier, you get out there and you play more and people hear about you and they want to give you a try. Well, John Anderson has always had a very orchestral mind. And what he envisioned for Yes was bringing an orchestra, a one-man orchestra, one-person orchestra, if you will, into the band to really help him flesh out the ideas that he was hearing for these songs. And Rick fit the bill. The story goes that Chris called Rick up at something like 3 a.m. and said, hey, this is Chris Squire of Yes. We'd like you to come down and play with the band. And Rick thought it was a crank call and hung up on him. Anyway, Chris called him again. He came down to the studio, and boy, they loved what they heard. In addition to the Mellotron and the Mini Moog, he played something called a Roxy chord. In the early days of Yes, when I would go see them in arenas, he actually had his grand piano boxed up after each show and brought to the next show. At a certain point, he had, I believe, 2 Mellotrons on stage with him and 2, possibly 3 Mini Moogs. And then the clavinet. Again, remember, this is before the keyboards that we're so used to now, where you have thousands of sounds. Clavinet, you know, gave you the clavinet. The Roxy chord gave you so on and so forth. But as time went on, he would acquire these other keyboards and add that to the mix. And yeah, John had his one person orchestra in the band.
Yeah, that's amazing. Such a talented guy. And as you said, great personality, Rick. You know, just one of those guys that you just want to keep listening to and learning from. And so I would love to play for you part of Rick Wakeman's 2013 NAMM Oral History interview. Nice. So we can get some of his insight.
Great.
I couldn't afford a Mini Moog or a Moog. They were just too expensive. But I got a couple of other bits and pieces and started going. I had four or five keyboards going out with Strauss. But then it came to the pier very quickly, because I was only with Strauss about a year and a half, and I got the offer to join Yes. It was interesting. The day I got asked if I'd join Yes, David asked if I would form Spiders from Mars with Mick Ronson. So it was, looking back, it was a bit like being given the, you know, do you want to play for Man United or Man City, really? It was very strange. But I joined Yes, and I remember sitting in the office of the manager, Brian Lane, who still looks after all my music and everything and that now, and he said, well, what keyboards have you got? So I got Hammond C3 organ. By that time, I'd bought a Hammond C3 on the Never Never from Chingford Organ Centre, and I said, I've got a Mellotron. He said, but the lads in the band love all the orchestral things that you're doing with them. What are they? I said, I haven't. I said, we just borrowed and rent. And he said, we'll have to get you a budget together to get some gear. And I went, all right. And I always remember he said, will you get, yes, we were on 50 quid a week. Now, in 1971, I mean, that was like twice what my dad was getting. I said, what? He said, yeah, you get 50 quid a week. But I can get a budget from the record company. We'll get you some gear. There were two pivotal moments for me watching the development of keyboards. It's just such a wonderful era to grow through, because there wasn't anything. I mean, you had the Hammond organ, a load of Italian electric pianos, and hardly anything else. And the Mellotron sort of appeared, but that was it. And you always played second fiddle to everything else that was out there, guitars or whatever. And then meeting Bob Moog with the Mini Moog, who loved musicians, loved players, wanted to talk to you about the instruments and how you wanted to play them, what you wanted to do, and produce an instrument that would cut through concrete and frighten guitarists. Thank you very much. It was absolutely lovely. That was a major pivotal moment for me in the 70s. And then the second really pivotal moment was, yes, you had the Mini Moog, you had a few keyboards come through. There was companies like Sequential Circuits that came up with the Prophet 5, which for my sins, I designed the look of it and that kind of thing, and other few other instruments that were being made. But there was no company or anybody appeared who had actually taken all the ingredients and everything and gone, oh, hold on a minute, let's really try and do something for everybody and moving forward at the same time. And then it was 1979. I was signed to MAM, which was Gordon Mills' company, and my manager at the time was a chap called Tony MacArthur, who we used to call the General. And he called me up to his office opposite the Westbury Hotel in London, and he said, what do you know about Korg? And I said, Korg? I said, well, they've been making a lot of keyboard instruments, very much appear to be geared towards scores or low end, you know, that's what they've been doing. I said, why? He said, they want you to go to Japan. I said, why? So they want to show you some keyboards. And I said, oh, okay. He said, do you want to go? And I said, yeah. And I said, what are the new keyboards? He said, they're completely changing everything in the way that they do it. And he said, the big boss president, Kato-san, personally inviting you to go over. I said, okay, fine. So I went over, and I'm grinning because there were some funny things that happened. I have to admit, there were some very funny things that happened. I don't know whether I'm allowed to tell them or not, but I was married to a Swiss lady at the time, Danielle, and we flew with Tony MacArthur over to Japan, where they'd got this new range of instruments. And the first one that they showed me was the Trident. And I still maintain to this day that the Trident is one of the cleverest instruments ever made. Absolutely sensational. It was basically three synths in one. So clever. There was certain things you had to get used to because there was variations in volumes and bits and pieces. But it was just so ahead of its time. And I thought, wow, this is something else. And then they'd got a couple of other solo instruments, the Sigma and the Lambda, I think there was then. The EP 20, something electric, 120, great. I mean, this is really great. I love this, is fantastic. And Kato-san said to me, he said, I can't remember the exact number. He said, at the moment, we are not number one. He said, why I'm speaking in that accent, I don't know, because he doesn't really speak English. It all came through Junko. So he went, and Junko went, Kato-san says, at the moment, we're not number one. He said, but next year, we will be. He said, but we need musicians to talk to us and to tell us. And he said, I want you to, would you like to take this out on to, and try it and come back with feedback about what works and whatever? And I said, okay. And I was off to Brazil, all around South America. And then I was going to South Africa or into Africa. And then I was going somewhere else. And I said, okay, what we will need is some spare parts to take with us. And there was a few looks around. There aren't any spare parts. So there was a little bit of a chatter. And I think Junko was still there. It was there at the time. She said, oh, Kato-san, it's not a problem. He'll give you three of everything. So, I mean, in freight, we paid so much money to cut all this stuff around. But the interesting thing was, hand on heart, we never had one breakdown. Now, this was the first time that keyboards we'd taken out that weren't flimsily made, that didn't fall apart. And we went, hold on a minute, this really got something here. So we came back and gave our report into Corgan Carter Science. And that was the moment, I suppose, for me when I thought this is going to be a pivotal moment in what happens in music. And it wasn't long after that, of course, that suddenly the famous M1 appeared, which Yamaha had the DX7, which they'd done, became the instrument that most keyboard players wanted to have. And then Korg produced the M1, which was the keyboard instrument that every keyboard player wanted to have. I don't know any keyboard player at the time that did not want or have an M1. And in fact, when you think about the sounds that are on the M1, that have actually continued through all the process of not just Korg instruments, but other instruments as well, is testament to what an absolutely brilliant instrument that was. And the thing that was fantastic, in the same way with Kato-san, or the same way with Bob Moog, is the enthusiasm that Kato had to all of his instruments and what was doing and the development that went on.
One of the things about Rick is his touch, mm-hmm. right? And I think that what he helped for a lot of people understand is that that is not lost in electronic musical instruments.
Right. Yeah.
A lot of people had thought that, okay, acoustic piano is where the touch is.
Mm-hmm.
Then they try to have those touch sensitive mm-hmm. electronic instruments like the Wurlitzer but I think Rick really proved that you can put a lot of emotion into the way you let go of a note.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, whether it's a touch-sensitive keyboard or not.
Mm-hmm.
And companies, I've got a Roland RD-800, and the piano touch technology in that is tremendous. It really is like playing a real acoustic piano. But yeah, I mean, Rick's solos on the Mini Moog in particular. Another funny thing he said was, once I got that in my hands, I wasn't, in the back of the stage anymore, sonically. I could compete with those loud guitar players. Watch out, here I come. That's not a touch-sensitive keyboard, and yet he plays it so lyrically and musically.
Beautiful, yeah, absolutely. Hey, let's move on to the drums, because Bill gets a lot of credit for many of the major projects he has been involved with, both before and after Yes. But just his work with Yes, I think, is worth looking at and mentioning in this podcast, not only because, of course, he was a member of the band, but what he brought to the table. What are your views about that?
You know, the first time I heard Yes, I was driving my mom's behemoth station wagon along the road, and this song comes on called Roundabout that I'd never heard before. You know how it starts with that amazing backwards piano chord, which today you can do in the computer. Back then, they had to run 40 yards of tape around the room. And Steve Howe's brilliant nylon string guitar intro. But when they get to the point where the band comes in, the sound of the drums was so crisp and so solid and so driving. And to me, the snare, I think he had the snares turned off. I'm not exactly sure. Or maybe it was a real deep snare. It was a snare sound like none I'd ever heard before. So that caught my ear. And of course, Yes is so well known for integrating odd time signatures smoothly too. You don't feel it, which is something I said to John when we were chatting one day. Other bands incorporate odd meter, but you really feel it. Kind of jerks you around a bit. Theirs is so smooth. And for a drummer to be in charge of that and make that happen, make that smooth, that's a daunting challenge.
I know. He has a great line, not in our interview, but something I read, I think it was actually in Rolling Stone. I'll give them some credit because they've gotten some awesome details out of the band members over the years. Bill said, driving the band with the drum, he's talking about, yes, driving the band with the drum is like running a train backwards and forwards at the same time. And just, I love that because, And then you think about it, you're right, these odd meters, but then stepping out of the way for those great solos, stepping out of the way for those melodic changes, that orchestration of all of that, it's not got to be easy to do.
No, right. No. Yeah, and he made it sound so easy. And in addition, of course, to Bill was Chris Squire's amazing bass, not just bass playing, but the lines that he would come up with. I mean, if you listen hard to the lines in Roundabout, try to transcribe something like that. That would be a huge challenge because he's moving from low to high. Another song on that same album that Roundabout was on, Heart of the Sunrise. Goodness.
Man.
So anyway, yes. They all contributed to that. The drive and the smoothness, you're in 4/4 for a second, 7/8 for a second, sometimes 11/8. It's flawless and very smooth, very musical.
That's awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So in 2011, I remember I got a hold of the road manager where Bill was gigging and said, oh, gosh, we'd love to do an interview for the oral history program at NAMM. And he says, well, no, he's not really doing interviews on this gig. It's very tight. It's, you know, there's one gig after another. Mm-hmm. There's different cities. I says, I'm totally respectful of that. You know, just let him know we're interested. So whenever it's available, just let me know.
Yeah.
I got a call the very next day. He says, as soon as I mentioned it was for NAMM, Bill says, when are we going to do it?
Wow.
And I'm like, great. Okay, yeah. I love this guy. And he was so, you know, one of those guys that you just feel like you're his buddy. In 5 minutes, you know, he's just totally open and honest and is grateful. As we mentioned earlier, when we were talking about members of the band being grateful for their fans, he's definitely one of them without a doubt. Yeah. And he almost makes it seem like, well, I'm not really worthy of being here. And then you hear him play. It's like, okay, dude, stop talking.
Right. I noticed a long time ago that as a general rule, the more talented they become, the more musically godlike, if you will, they become, the more humble they are. Because, as you said earlier, they're thankful for what life has offered them. John Anderson says the same thing all the time. You know, people ask him, well, do you feel lucky or was it meant to? Oh, no, I feel very lucky because there's a lot of people who are equally worthy of being here. And, you know, just a few kind of make that leap all the way to the top of the pie.
Yeah. So for those of you who haven't had time to chat with Bill, listen in on a little bit of his NAM oral history interview now, and I bet you're going to be endeared to him like we are. Here's Mr. Bill.
1968, I said, we're going to try this music thing. I'm going to go to London, see if I can get any work as a musician. You know, I'm so naive, unbelievable. But it was just that period when music was exploding. Everybody was in a band. And by the summer of that year, we'd formed Yes. So, and that began to get under steam in 1968. It didn't have any success for a couple of years. We just kind of were just floating for a couple of years.
Well, that's an incredible story.
Yeah, so in a way, Yes was my first gig. Wow. You know, I hadn't really played any music to anybody much in public before then.
There is an introduction.
I thought I knew everything, though. That didn't stop me having a lot of opinions about music, you know.
Well, so tell me how the band was formed. How did you meet the guys? And
well, it's a little different over in the UK to hear how it is in the States. In those days, the entire business was really of employing musicians in the rock or jazz field was governed by one newspaper, a weekly called The Melody Maker. And if you put an advertisement in there, and, you know, some guy might answer. And I put an ad in, and John Anderson and Chris Squire rang up and said, well, we're in the bar down the road. Do you want to come and meet us? And we played something that evening. We played a gig that evening, I think. We played In the Midnight Hour by Wilson Pickett for about 2 hours. That was about all we knew. But they could sing. You know, they sounded great. And I thought, this is terrific. We can do this. Very excited. So we started as a covers band. You know, in a way, jazz musicians tend to use standard American songbook as their raw material, as you know. And the equivalent for rock guys is they use the standard pop tunes of the day and kind of change them a bit. And it's a very good template, because if you take a song like When I'm 64 by the Beatles or something, we all know that. But if you change it a little bit and put your little kink into it and put your sound on it, you're already halfway there. Your listener knows the song. So I'm kind of a believer in covers, hip covers, cover versions for bands to start with. I'm not talking about doing an exact copy. I'm talking about taking the material and applying whatever you think you have to it. I'm kind of a fan of that. So we started doing that. We did Beatles tunes. Hey, we did some Leonard Bernstein and West Side Story, did a bit of that. There was a vocal group, American vocal group of the day called The Fifth Dimension. We did some of their material, little Vanilla Fudge. I mean, you know, we liked everything. A little Stravinsky, a little Sibelius, it was all in there. It was great. Not much jazz. And then what subsequently, as you may know, what happened with progressive rock after that, really, there wasn't much jazz in any of this. If there was any jazz at all, it was me, because, you know, I had the sensibility of a jazz musician to try to invent music then and there. We got off to a slowish start. The first couple of years were slow, but then suddenly we curved up really fast.
Hmm. And were you pretty happy with the direction of the band?
I was. I did about 5 albums and got as far as Close to the Edge, which was a big hit. And I really loved that. I thought it was a tremendous record. And we were very lucky, I think. I don't think anybody to this day quite knows how that record got made. It was kind of assembled. It was edited. It was, is this going to work? I don't know. Is this going to work? I mean, we've lost the form. We're all arguing. You know, it's complicated stuff. But it was a huge success. And they wanted to go on and do another, even more complicated, you know, four-sided record. This Close to the Edge only had 3 tracks on it, one of which was 20 minutes, the one side of an album, and 2 10-minute tracks on the other side, you know, which is all you could fit on. For younger listeners who don't know how much time is on a vinyl album. And they wanted to go on and do more, a double album after that. And I thought, you know what? I feel I've done this. I feel I've spent my time here. I've learned an awful lot. I love the band. I'd rather move on. because with a jazz background, I kind of assumed that what you did in music was you moved through groups in order to give and take what you could to groups. You didn't necessarily stay in the same place. And to this day, the idea of, you know, just being, you know, a rock star and staying in one band for your whole life and then retiring doesn't appeal to me. I'd like to keep going a bit and change.
We were blessed to do an interview in 2016 with John Anderson. Thanks very much to you, Mr. Bill. And I think this is a great way to bookend this conversation about Yes, because can you imagine that band without him?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that runs through my mind often when I'm listening to Yes is just how much the individual really does play into the band. You know, when you think about a band, most of the time, I think of how well they play together.
Yes.
Right? And they do, of course, play great together. But their individual stamp that they bring, that personal style mm-hmm. that they bring that is part of that sound, is amazing to me. And I don't think you can categorize that any better than what John Anderson does.
Yeah, so true. I mean, his voice is absolutely unique. I've never heard a voice like that in rock or pretty much any other kind of music. Voice of an angel. And they took full advantage of not just the voice, but sort of making him look angelic, you know, a spot overhead when he's all dressed in white. Wonderful. Now, Chris Squire apparently was the harmony genius because he had been a choir student. So he would write a lot of their harmonies. So John, Chris, and Steve would sing a lot together. And then, of course, later Trevor, when he was in the band, I think Alan would sing a bit too. Anyway, John's voice is the most unique, absolutely, in rock. And again, my opinion, the rest of the world. But he's also a very studied man. He reads, as I said earlier, you know, Siddhartha, War and Peace. And so his creations are much deeper than what you would sort of maybe normally expect with a rock band experience. And he's really telling a story and taking people on a journey, which is why in his mind he needed this one-person orchestra. Chris Squire's bass lines were as much a part of driving that orchestra. And, of course, Steve Howe, with his lap steel on a stand, wearing an acoustic around his neck, having an electric on another stand, you know, three, four different instruments in one piece. Visually, it was a tremendous show. And it also just helped create this whole picture that musically John wanted to share with the world.
Absolutely. That's amazing. I appreciate that insight. It's so cool that we can get to know some of these guys, right? Yeah. Because you can really see that glint in their eye when mm-hmm. they start talking about, oh, yeah, well, when we did it this way right, or when we played this gig.
Yeah.
I love that about John, because he is passionate about what he does and what he has done.
Yes.
So let's take a second to listen to some of John Anderson's NAMM oral history interview.
When Yes started, you know, all of a sudden I'm working with Tony Kaye and Bill Bruford and Steve Howe. Well, you know, originally Peter Banks, you know, and then Steve Howe came along, then Rick Wakeman. And all of a sudden you're working with these fascinating people and brilliant musicians. And part of my growth was being able to sort of conduct them, you know, and come up with ideas for them, you know, and that was my whole growing period of the 70s was I was growing up with the music as everybody else was listening to it. So
I know you've told the story, but can you tell us the story about how the name of the band came about?
Well, Peter Banks came up with Yes, because the original name of the band was Mabel Greer's Toy Shop, you know, Chris Squire, you know, a lot of acid there. And I kept saying, it's too long, Mabel Greer's Toy Shop. No, it's too long. So I said, let's get a, you know, I came up with Life, and Chris came up with World, and then Peter Banks said, why not call Yes? And we all said, is it the Yes? And he said, no, Yes. And that was the beginning of the whole procession of events.
Did you ever dream it would be what it's become?
No, you never do. You think, you know, two or three years, if you're lucky, you know. And the first tour we went on as Yes was The Who, Rod Stewart, Small Faces, Joe Cocker, Arthur Brown, and Yes. Can you imagine that kind of a tour? God. Incredible. So we've been so fortunate, so thankful. You know, most musicians are grateful if they're lucky to know that. They should be thankful, grateful. The business is another game, you know. Music is like endless, you know.
Very cool. Can we talk a little bit about your songwriting? How did that come about for you?
Well, as I said, when I met Chris, I started writing songs. So I started, you know, there was many songs, like the number 13 bus was the bus that I caught from where I was living to rehearsals. I thought it was a good song, you know. It's like, no. So, you'd write five or six songs and one they would listen to, you know. And, you know, you learn to, over the years, you create a sort of style or craft where you think, oh, this is a good chord change. I have no idea what kind of chord it is, because I have no idea about, per se, music in a sense. I'll play the guitar, but I don't know exactly. I know E, A, G, C, F, and the rest is like, what's this? Oh, it sounds great. I don't know what it is. And, you know, Steve would say, oh, that's a seven-sided ninth or something like that. I don't know. I said, well, it sounds good. And Rick said, well, you can't play that there. I said, yeah, you can. You can go, dawn of light, lime, through silence of soul sources, chaste and effusions of wonder. Okay, you can play that. You know, you have to sort of juggle it around. So over the years, you know, you grow artistically because you listen to some great songwriters, you know, Randy Newman, you know, Ricky Lee, all these great musicians over the years, you know. Nina Simone was my initial favorite.
Really?
In the 60s, yeah, big time. So, you know, you just know that these people that write, of course, the Beatles wrote the best songs for me, and Paul McCartney, of course, and John Lennon. But over the years, you start to listen to other people, like, I know so many, you know, so many great songs. And it's as though you wish you'd written that song. So you try to emulate it by writing something totally different. But because of that song, that's why you write that song, you know.
Well, and also you use it as a way of expression. And I kind of think it's interesting. So many of your songs have helped other people express their own feelings.
Yeah, I think I got that initially from All You Need Is Love, you know. And that's a Krishna thing, you know. That comes from that period of time, Revolver, and Sergeant Pepper, you know, Tomorrow Never Knows, and things like that. You think, how did they come up with that kind of thing, you know, that kind of song? And it was very revolutionary at that time.
So, Mr. Bill, speaking of John Anderson, I'm sort of curious about the Yes Heads and, and his opinion of that amazing group of fans that follow them everywhere they go.
Mm-hmm.
What does John think about the fans?
Oh, well, he loved it. Nothing validates what you're doing as a musician more than knowing you've touched so many people the world over who then revere you for what you do. And I'm sure at a certain point you start to recognize fans that have been to your shows constantly. But yeah, having that amount of connection, knowing that your music is reaching into their soul and elevating their existence in whatever way it does, It's quite a tribute, quite a thank you, I guess, to the artists.
Yeah, no doubt about it. That is awesome. So tell me about a little bit about the work that you've done with John over the years.
Sure. You know, again, I first heard Roundabout when I was in high school and just immediately thought, I got to meet these guys somehow. I know they all live in England at the time, but somehow, some way, I've got to meet them. And a couple times after concerts, I was able to find out what hotel they were staying at. And I would call up, want to talk to John, and they'd put me through. And this very lovely, lilting, lyrical, Accrington-accented voice would say hello. And that's when all of a sudden I was speechless. people who know me are going to say, no, you're never speechless. But I couldn't think of much to say, but I just wanted to connect with him and the rest of the band. And so I, you know, went to concerts. I would go to, he had a great album called Animation that was a solo album, and he did a tour with that. Mm. And then along about 2004 or 5, because I would also follow his website, and there was a little blurb on the website that said, John Anderson is looking for keyboardists, orchestrators, and musicians for a vast array of projects. And that's exactly how it was worded. If you're interested, send an email to this address. Boy, that's, talk about a gift, right? So, of course, I emailed immediately. And didn't hear anything back for a long time. Well, nothing ventured, nothing gained, you know. About 6 months later, an email shows up, says, sorry about the delay. If you're still interested, please send 1 minute of your best work, a little recording MP3 or whatever it was they wanted. Please no personal messages, you know, no, hey, I want to get to, you know, just send some music. And I sent a piece. You know, time went by. I thought, well, okay, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And then I get an email one day, and in the subject line it just says John here. And I generally toss emails if I, you know, who's that, is this a spam, is this a whatever, gonna ruin my computer. The only thing that saved it was that he spells his name without the H. J-O-N. I thought, oh, maybe that's John Anderson. And so I opened it up, and I could hear his voice even though I was just reading the email. I says, hi Bill, John Anderson here, I love your work, can you send me some more? Sure. So I sent him another couple of pieces. Unfortunately, I wasn't by my phone, but he phoned up immediately after that, said, okay, I want to send you some melodies and you can start to orchestrate them.
Wow.
So I did a couple of short ones first, and then he sent me 7 melodies, all on sort of a synth violin, where he had this whole idea. He wanted to it to be a violin concerto at first, but then as I started to orchestrate, he says, this sounds more like a ballet to me. So we went kind of in that direction, less of the violin taking off and doing its solo concerto type playing, and more of a more dance, more movement oriented music. And then John, being John, his mind is always thinking of the next part of the story. He decided it would be a ballet, and he wrote a whole story about this fella who discovers a crystal violin in a dumpster, because he's living on the streets, and he climbs in the dumpster to sleep at night. I mean, I'm just going, yeah, okay, let's go. So it took a few years, because it was 7 melodies, and he said, just turn the melody inside out, upside down, change keys, do whatever you want to it. So I would send him sort of progress reports as I was going. There was only one time I used like a woodblock sound, sort of an Appalachian Spring, Copeland thing. And he said, yeah, let's take that out, but otherwise. So after a few years, I had the 7 pieces done. And I think it runs about an hour. Mm. And we named it Violin Stories. He found a tremendous artist named J.C. Baez to start doing sort of mock-ups of the storyline. That's where that is, but you know, John continues to write, continues with the ideas. We just did a 4-piece work called Opus that he's really hoping to bring to the stage someday. So, you know.
That's awesome.
His mind, as far as I'm concerned, just never stops creating, and that's wonderful. And back to the humility. The first time I met him, my daughter, Shannon, was going up to college in San Francisco Bay Area, and so I was driving up Highway 1, and I knew John lived kind of in that, not quite San Francisco, but he lived in that area that I was driving through, and I said, hey, I'd love to stop by and actually meet you. He said, okay, and he gave me his address, and I drove up, and he walked out of his studio and just walked up to me and gave me a big old hug like we'd known each other for years. What a humble guy. And then he's talking about, yeah, well, there's this idea I have, you know, on guitar. He's got these nice guitars sitting in his studio. I said, well, do you mind if I... No, no, go ahead. Now I'm like, okay, better put up or shut up. So, you know, he started singing what he was hearing, and I was able to play it on guitar. He says, you play good guitars. So that was a real validation for me.
No doubt about it. That is amazing. Well, let's hear a little bit more of John Anderson from his 2016 NAMM Oral History interview.
During the course of my career, I've really got into trying to explain what I'm thinking, what's going on in my state of mind. Because I was never going to write a song about love won, love lost. That's your general pop music, you know. I was never going to write that because it's already been done so many times. So I would write Starship Trooper, you know, and all about Starship Trooper is all about your higher consciousness, what drives you to want to know more about why you're in this moment, you know. So many reasons you write songs, you know.
Well, since you brought up Starship Trooper, I would love to have you tell me a little bit about how you came up with some of the concepts in that song. I love it.
Well, Sister Bluebird, Bluebird is a very strong emblem. There was an incredibly, the fastest boat in the 60s, 70s was the Bluebird, the fastest boat, and the fastest car, Bluebird. They always said the Bluebird was this powerful, you know, enigmatic or whatever, enigmatic, what a word. Anyway, so when I say Sister Bluebird, flying high above, this is my higher self talking to me. She can see me, but don't tell me, because what I don't know, I can't sing about. You know, I've got to find it out myself, sort of thing. And Starship Trooper was a book by Heinlein, a sci-fi book. And I just used it as a metaphor, again, for your higher consciousness talking to you about where you're from. Well, I'd say, don't tell me, because then I will know. I don't want to know. I'm still searching, sort of thing. So the song evolves around that, you know.
What did the band think when you would propose songs like that? Were they always...
They were, you know, Chris especially was always very ready for something from me. He was very, very receptive. Mm. And at that time, I was writing with Chris a lot, and Steve, more Steve, because Steve had all these chords. He sort of blew my mind with his chord structures and things. So it was easy for me to work with Steve just simply because of his guitar work, you know. And I think more or less over the years, I started to write my own work and bring it to the band, like Gates of Delirium I'd written on the piano all the way through. I mean, as crazy as it may seem. And that's when I started to open up and start to compose structures and then bring it to the band, and they would sort of open it up more and more. Like Awaken is one of the most wonderful pieces of Yes music. And that started off with listening to Steve doing a riff. And I went back to his room, and he's still playing the riff. And I said, can you change the key? And he played it in a different key, and I started singing. And all of a sudden, this music started to unfold. And that's when you know it's not actually you. You're sort of a tenant to the music energy that surrounds you, and you're bringing it into the reality. And that's the great thing about music, that it's not mine. It's around everywhere. I'm just can do it, you know, bringing it in to my world. And then hopefully somebody likes it.
All right. Well, that again was John Anderson from his NAMM Oral History Interview talking about his amazing career. And this has been a pleasure for me. We love talking about Yes. Yes, we do.
Yes, I do.
And Mr. Bill, thank you so much for coming. I really, really appreciate you being here. And Alex, as always, it's a pleasure to work with you. What are your thoughts about this podcast?
Bill, this is so wonderful to hear a different perspective, a very insider perspective, and hearing about the people that you've met and who made this fantastic music.
Thank you. Thank you, Alex. Alex and Dan, it's been an extreme pleasure for me. I used to have conversations with one of my old bass player friends for hours about this band, because we were both that moved by them. And Dan gave me the go-ahead, the permission to plug a couple of songs that I do have in YouTube video form with John. So if you're interested in looking them up, one is called Surfing with God, and that came about because I talked to John about my time in the ocean on my boogie board all the time. So Surfing with God, John Anderson. And then the other one is called First Nation, also, of course, John Anderson. So I made little videos and put them up on YouTube, and if you're interested, check them out. They're
awesome. I've listened to both of them, and they're fantastic. Great stuff. Mr. Bill, as always, what a pleasure hanging out with you. Thank you, sir.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to The Music History Project. This has been Dan Del Fiorentino
and Alex Rossner.
If you like what you heard today, please subscribe on iTunes and leave us some feedback. If you have ideas for future podcasts or recommendations for interviews for the Oral History Program, please send an email to library@namm.org. That's library@namm.org.